As the interwar period progressed, the two largest navies on the planet, the US Navy and the Royal Navy, began to realize that the carrier restrictions in the Washington Naval Treaty and First London Treaty may have been a mistake. Washington had set overall tonnage limits, both for the overall number of carriers and the tonnage of individual carriers, at a time when the capability of aircraft against ships, as opposed to scouting for them, was very much in its infancy. This, in turn, meant that there were a limited number of large fleet carriers that could be built. The First London Naval Treaty had closed a loophole that the Japanese had tried to exploit, wherein ships under 10,000 tons, designed purely to operate aircraft, had not originally been classified as anything that was subject to limitations. Now, you'll note in the following video that the Imperial Japanese Navy doesn't get all that much of a mention. This is because while many of the ideas we're going to discuss were also explored and in some cases implemented in the Imperial Japanese Navy, their pre-war and early war efforts were almost entirely focused on supplementing their main carrier fleet and scouting capability, and thus their ideas merit separate consideration as compared to the mostly secondary roles for the ships that we're going to look at here. Now, as time went on, during the interwar period and aircraft capabilities improved, it was becoming clear that aircraft had many, many more uses, but there just wasn't enough tonnage to build enough hulls to provide enough flight decks for these aircraft to be used in the ways that people wanted to. Pretty much all available tonnage was needed to ensure a full complement of fleet carriers was maintained, but there were many other needs that really a carrier could fulfill quite well. For example, providing aircraft to scout well ahead of or independent of the fleet, to conduct commerce protection and or commerce raiding, to conduct anti-submarine hunting, peacetime anti-piracy patrols, transport of aircraft to and from various overseas bases, pilot training, and resupplying fleet carriers that might end up with more pilots than aircraft after various actions. And all of these needs just weren't able to be met. This led to a few different lines of thought developing. One was the idea of a hybrid warship, both battle carriers at battleship tonnage displacements and cruiser carriers, which are pretty self-explanatory, which could provide additional flight decks. But these ideas mostly went away as quickly as they came. The provision of extensive aircraft facilities cut significantly into the capacity of tonnage-limited ships of the interwar period to be able to provide enough firepower to then compete in a surface action against purely gun-based vessels, and the fragile and flammable nature of aircraft hangars was a huge risk in a gunfight. Another idea was to take a look at various ships currently in other roles or being planned for them, things like liners and large freighters for the most part, although some warships, especially those that were expected to reach the end of their useful lives as surface combatants, were also considered. The idea was to come up with plans to rapidly convert these vessels into auxiliary carriers in time of war. In the US, these ships were divided into two categories. Light aircraft carriers would be hulls that could keep up with at least the fleet and ideally the full fleet carriers, and escort carriers for those which could not and thus would be useful only for secondary roles. The final idea was to actually build some of these smaller carriers during peacetime, accepting that one or more fleet carriers' tonnage might have to be sacrificed. In the mid-1930s, although the Royal Navy expected that in the event of war, the Home Fleet, Coastal Command, and the use of ASDIC would contain enemy raiders, both surface and subsurface, that might try to escape into the Atlantic from Germany, and likewise the Mediterranean Fleet and various forces based at Gibraltar could contain the Regia Mariner, there was a bit more of a problem if they had to face the Imperial Japanese Navy. That navy couldn't be bottled up, and thus it could head for Australia or New Zealand or into the Indian Ocean or any other number of other places the British really didn't want them to go. Additionally, pre-positioned German or Italian ships and submarines could operate beyond the cordons designed to contain those fleets if those ships and submarines were overseas at the time that war was declared. And thus came the concept for the Trade Protection Carrier, a dedicated design of around 10,000 tons that, at least initially in concept, used Hermes as a starting point, although ideas developed during the interwar period. The program called for one of these trade protection carriers to be built alongside each fleet carrier, and possibly the program could be accelerated. This seemed to be possible by the mid-1930s, as it looked likely that with the upcoming Second London Naval Treaty, a cap on the size and armament of individual ships would be retained, but the overall tonnage restrictions, and thus restrictions on the overall number of ships you could have, would probably go by the wayside. However, even with increased funding for rearmament from 1935 and 1936 onward, there still wasn't enough to modernise the existing battle fleet, refresh and renew the battle fleet by building new ships, and build a fleet of these smaller carriers. So instead, it was decided to look into the auxiliary aircraft carrier. These would be conversions, earmarking specific merchant ships that they thought might be suitable for the purpose, and preparing at least outline sketch plans on how they might be converted. But even this much reduced plan, which was largely a paperwork exercise, got largely subsumed by the other work that was needed to update the Royal Navy, and even when war broke out, the need for every possible merchant hull to do its normal job, as well as projections that the larger and more ambitious conversions, and thus also the most useful, would need at least a year to accomplish and absorb resources which were not in particularly plentiful supply, saw the entire idea dropped. Initially, the major surface threats were a few large German warships, and the Kriegsmarine was largely, if not entirely, contained to the North Sea. Although the raiders, like Graf Spee, were relatively quickly dealt with, and further raiders were thought best stopped using large surface warships on patrol, there were a number of setbacks in the carrier department. In the absence of smaller carriers, attempts to use fleet carriers to hunt submarines instead resulted in a number of hair-raising near misses and, of course, the loss of HMS Courageous, in large part thanks to early demands of the war, leaving her with a pitifully small escort. The loss of Courageous and her sister ship Glorious meant that the Royal Navy only had Eagle, Furious, and Ark Royal in terms of large carriers by spring 1940. Illustrious had just about commissioned, but she wouldn't be available for a while she worked up, and the next hull due to arrive would be Formidable, and she wouldn't even commission until the end of the year. At almost the same time, the fall of Norway, the campaign which had cost Glorious, and then the fall of France, meant that any idea of an Anglo-French cordon of Kriegsmarine surface and submarine raiding efforts went completely out the window, and the Mediterranean demanded most of the fleet carrier's attention anyway, because in the North Sea, you could at least use land-based aircraft. This led to a series of emergency stopgap measures. Five ships under Admiralty control were turned into fighter catapult ships, with a single, mostly lifetime-expired Hawker Hurricane fitted on a catapult, and with rockets strapped to them, they would be launched into the skies. In the event of a German long-range patrol aircraft showing up, which might attack the convoy itself or summon U-boats, the very brave pilot would have to climb into this contraption and be rocketed off to ideally shoot down, or at least drive off, the enemy patrol aircraft, after which they'd have to make a controlled ditching in the freezing cold waters of the North Atlantic, ideally close enough to be picked up by a ship from the convoy before they froze to death. This scheme was also extended to regular merchant ships, which became catapult-armed merchantmen, or CAM ships. While better than nothing, it was also a surprisingly rarely used feature, both because of the risk to the pilot and the one-shot nature of the launch. Once you'd fired off that Hurricane, you weren't getting it back, and if another aircraft showed up, well, you were out of options. All told, there were 10 operational launches, resulting in 9 German aircraft destroyed, 1 damaged, and another that was forced to withdraw. One pilot, Flight Officer Kendall, launching off of the SS Empire Morn in defence of Convoy QP-12, was lost after driving off a BV-138 and shooting down a JU-88. For reasons unknown, he decided to bail out instead of ditching, and was seen to fall towards the sea with his parachute only opening at the absolute last minute, which was sadly not soon enough to prevent significant injuries from a high-speed impact with the water, from which he fairly soon died. Some thought he may have struck the tail of the fighter as he jumped, since he was otherwise a very experienced pilot. Now you'll note that 10 launches resulted in only 9 Hurricanes lost. And that's because one launch, from HMS Maplin, was actually close enough to Ireland that the pilot elected to just go and land at an RAF station there instead of risking the cold waters of the Atlantic. The next logical step was the Merchant Aircraft Carrier, or MAC, ship. This saw a basic flight deck built over the hull of a merchant vessel that would otherwise continue to carry its normal cargo. This offered both the ability to carry multiple aircraft and the theoretical capability to recover them afterwards. The proposal would allow for the use of up to 6 fighters on the chosen vessels, but it was put on hold for a while due to the logical evolution of the idea, the conversion of ships to become dedicated carriers, which again in British terms were auxiliary aircraft carriers. The MAC idea would, however, reemerge further down the line, this time with 4 slightly larger anti-submarine warfare aircraft instead of fighters, and would be implemented on a variety of ships, with grain carriers being more popular, as they could easily use 1 or 2 of their cargo holds as makeshift hangars, whereas MAC-converted tankers could not do so, and all the aircraft had to remain on deck in all weathers, and they all had to be shuffled forward when a launched aircraft needed to come into land. The auxiliary aircraft carrier's first true example in the Royal Navy came about with the conversion of a ship that, even in early 1941, had a convoluted history. The 11,000-ton ship in question had been built as a mixed-use cargo liner named Hanover in Germany in the late 1930s. She'd been commissioned just before the start of the war, and she'd actually been in the West Indies when war broke out, but had then tried to play blockade runner the following year. But she'd then been intercepted by the cruiser HMS Dunedin and the destroyer HMCS Assiniboine, I think that's how it's pronounced anyway. Although Hanover had tried to scuttle herself, she was boarded, the fires put out, the seacocks closed, and she was taken as a prize. She was then renamed briefly to Sinbad, but upon being taken into service by the Ministry of War Transport, she was renamed again to Empire Audacity and turned into an ocean boarding vessel, ironically assigned to stop and board other blockade runners. But at the start of 1941, she was taken into Royal Navy service and sent over to the dockyards in Blyth, where her upper works were cut down, a flight deck was installed, and she returned to service in June of the same year as HMS Empire Audacity, which was very quickly shortened to HMS Audacity. Due to the quick and experimental nature of the conversion, she didn't actually have a hangar, so her complement of theoretically up to 8 Martlet fighters were afforded only the questionable protection of a windbreak. In just under 4 months of service, she managed to shoot down 7 Focke-Wulf 200 Condors and damage the U-boat U-131 sufficiently to force it to scuttle, in exchange for the loss of 2 of her fighters. However, her service was cut short by U-751, which caught her outside convoy HG-76 one night, backlit by a flare fired from a merchant ship. She'd quickly gotten a reputation among the Germans, and there were specific orders to sink her. 3 torpedoes quickly sent her to the bottom. However, she had proven the general concept, with 1 big and 1 small caveat. She'd been flush-decked, and the lack of vision for her captain was listed as a major reason that she'd been operating outside the convoy, so to avoid collision. This and a few other factors meant that it was determined that future ships would need an island, however small, for command and control operations. That was the big caveat. The smaller caveat was that a hangar would ideally be much preferred, both to ease air operations generally and to reduce wear and tear on aircraft at sea. This led to 2 new branches of work for the Royal Navy. Other merchant ships under construction or considered useful were quickly listed for conversion, starting with the Telemachus, a refrigerated transport ship then under construction, which would be converted on the stocks into a small carrier which was named HMS Activity. This came with radar, an island, workshops, and a small hangar serviced by a single elevator with a mixed air group of swordfish and martlets. The other branch of work, given the speed at which these small carriers were needed and the rather hodgepodge nature of converting existing ships of differing specifications, was to order a bunch from the USA. Which brings us neatly to considering what the US Navy had been up to this point. Now, in the interwar period, the US Navy had maintained plans for what it termed XCVs, a short list of merchant ships that could be converted to aircraft carriers at relatively short notice, but most of these plans were looking more at larger, swifter vessels, like ocean liners, which could then be turned into fleet carrier analogues. At one point, it was even considered that subsidising the construction of an ocean liner that happened to have a full flight deck, ostensibly for peacetime use by mail planes. And although it was thought a good idea at the time, it was eventually abandoned on the fact that it would cost a huge amount in subsidies to persuade people to change the layout of an ocean liner from the traditional method to one with just one massive open deck up top. Now, while at times the XCV ship list looked more at smaller and slower ships, the general theme was for a fleet supplemental program, not unlike that which gave the Imperial Japanese Navy the Hiyo and Junyo. As the 1930s drew to a close and World War II broke out in Europe, the US Navy began to look more closely into various conversion ideas. This was helped by the Royal Navy, providing some of the plans that they'd drawn up for various conversions in the mid-1930s, as we've described earlier, and along with an abortive attempt to implement the XCV program, hampered in part by the need to turn liners into troop ships rather than carriers, and by the X-liner Normandy catching fire during attempts to reduce her superstructure, these plans went in a number of directions. One was the conversion of a number of Cleveland-class cruisers into Independence-class light fleet carriers, and another was a program that would eventually result in the escort carrier, or CVE. It wasn't known as that at first, though. Initially, it was termed an APV, or special escort ship. The US program is said to have one of two origins, or possibly a combination of both, depending on what you read. In October 1940, President Roosevelt forwarded the idea for a ship that would have a speed of at least 15 knots, be displaced between 6,000 and 8,000 tons, and would be capable of operating around a dozen aircraft. Either the rather promising brand new helicopter, or possibly autogyros, depending on your source, or some kind of short takeoff and landing anti-submarine patrol aircraft. At the same time, in October 1940, Admiral Halsey, then in command of the US Navy's carrier force, proposed a somewhat larger 600-foot-long vessel capable of at least 19 knots. He held that this vessel could be used to train new pilots, which would free up fleet carriers from the role, allowing them to be on the front lines, and they could also be used for moving aircraft around, both from the continental United States to existing forward US Navy fleet bases like Pearl Harbor, and then from those areas to further afield places like the Philippines, or to other bases that might need to be built at short notice and then stocked with aircraft, again freeing fleet carriers from this role. By late 1940, there was already British interest in acquiring small aircraft carriers from the US, and so at the start of 1941, not only was it proposed to build a prototype, but to consider in the selection of ships for conversion the availability of a sister ship, or at least a similar vessel, which could then be purchased by the British. A pair of diesel-powered C3-type cargo ships, the Mormac Mail and the Mormac Land, were selected, and the initial design looked a little bit like half a carrier, with a 305-foot-long flush deck for landing mounted aft up to roughly amidships, and then just a catapult forward for launching. Initially, the US Navy estimated that it would take between a year and a half to complete the conversion, but when they were told, you're not supposed to be building a miniature fleet carrier. You're supposed to be building an unsophisticated floating runway with just enough durability and safety for day-to-day secondary line operations. It turned out that Moore MacMail emerged in just under 3 months as USS Long Island, along with a redesignation from APV-1 to AVG-1. Initially, her flight deck was actually 362 feet long as completed, as it extended from the stern to just over the top of the pilot house, which remained from her time as a freighter. A hangar serviced by a single elevator occupied the aft end of the ship under the flight deck, and she had a mixed armament consisting of a single 5-inch 51 caliber gun for surface action, a pair of 3-inch 50 caliber anti-aircraft guns, and 450 caliber machine guns. Thanks to the flight deck being built at a height that was sufficient to clear the pilot house and other existing major superstructure, a decision that had been taken in the interests of speed, as it meant they didn't have to cut down that superstructure, the flight deck had a very significant freeboard, which was positively remarked on. After some testing, the catapult was realigned from the 30-degree angle that it had had originally, to launching straight ahead, although the whole thing was offset slightly to port. And the flight deck was extended another 77 feet forward, which gave her an appearance more typical of aircraft carriers in general and her successors in particular. There was no island, though, just the pilot house that was now fully under the flight deck, although the bridge wings were extended to either side of it. There was a small mast on the starboard side right forward, which would be enhanced later on in service. Some 1-inch plating was installed to notionally protect the magazines from at least blast and splinters, but that was all she got in terms of armour. As a conversion, she did also need a significant amount of ballast to compensate for all the extra top weight, and of course the lack of cargo in her holds. Most of these lessons were incorporated into her sister, Moore MacLand, which was being converted at almost the same time. She would emerge into Royal Navy commission as HMS Archer. The Royal Navy's requests for smaller carriers from US yards had taken a little bit of sorting out to firm up. At first, the requests had been simply for Audacity-style conversions, and then they'd moved on to a ship with a small hangar and an elevator, but such a small elevator that it was unable to take fixed-wing fighters like the early Wildcat-Martlets. But the US Navy had batted these ideas away, asserting that their own planned C-3 hull-based conversion would be much superior. And the Long Island, as well as the subsequent BAVG ships, or British AVG ships, starting with Archer, rather proved their point. These were capable of operating 15 to 20 aircraft, and they could keep them all nice and dry in the hangar. The subsequent ships in this small program, the Avenger, Biter, Dasher, and Charger, quickly worked out various other points of design. Avenger had a far more substantial mast on its starboard forward side, and subsequent ships, starting with Biter, had a small island. Charger actually ended up being retained by the US Navy for study and use as a training vessel. The next ship in this sequence, HMS Tracker, moved on from diesel power, which had proved somewhat troublesome, at least in the iteration that was being used on these C-3 type hulls, but which had been selected because it was easier to trunk the exhaust gases out, over to a more common steam turbine design. And this formed the basis for a 22-strong set of vessels that were converted from existing complete or near-complete C-3 type hulls, with wider flight decks than their predecessors, as well as, of course, an island. These vessels would be split evenly between the US Navy and the Royal Navy, becoming the Bogue class in the US Navy and the Attacker class in the Royal Navy. A further 23 vessels, dubbed the Ruler class, would be built for the Royal Navy to roughly the same pattern, but they would be built from the keel up as escort carriers using the C-3 hull, as opposed to taking ships that were complete or near complete and cutting them back down again. The somewhat more efficient design allowing the ships to increase their air group to almost 24 or so. The whole class also featured substantially longer hangars than the Long Island and its near sisters, since there was no existing superstructure to get in the way. Any that had been in place was cut down in these cases. And that meant that there were also two elevators, one at each end of the hangar, allowing much quicker and much more efficient aircraft operation. Around this time, the AVG designation was changed to CVE, and this designation was also applied retroactively to pre-existing ships. While all this was going on, the US Navy also converted four T3 type oiler hulls into the Sangamon class escort carriers. These were held to be somewhat better ships, as the aft centered machinery of an oiler made hangar arrangements much easier than the center mounted machinery on the C3 type hull. The T3 hull was also somewhat longer, which obviously made for a longer flight deck and a longer hangar, and the main deck, where the hangar was based, on an oiler was flat. On the C3 hull, there was a significant amount of shear and camber, which meant that the bogues and their derivatives had to rather hastily have various winches and cables installed in the hangar to allow the aircraft to be moved around easily, and in rough conditions it was just batten the things down and hope they didn't shift. But a critical lack of oilers for the US Navy meant that no more Sangamons would be forthcoming in the near future. With a total of 54 hulls built, concluding with HMS Reaper, it seemed that the escort carrier program might now finish, except for the fact that some believed even more carriers were needed, both for anti-submarine warfare and for more general work. And all of this combined with one Henry J. Kaiser showing up with a plan to mass produce between 50 and 100 escort carriers to a brand new design. These ships would be designed as escort carriers from the keel up, and as a result were far more efficient. The Casablanca class used twin screws and distributed machinery for more survivability, and on a smaller hull than either of the two previous classes, they managed to fit a longer hangar than could be found in either the Bogues or the Sangamons, as well as a longer flight deck than the Bogues, which, coupled with the hangar deck actually being flat, meant that they were cheaper than earlier ships for the same or greater aviation capacity and significantly nicer to operate as well. Being a fraction faster also helped with getting more heavily laden aircraft into the skies when every knot mattered. All 50 Casablanca class would enter US Navy service, and they would see extensive use in both the Atlantic and the Pacific. Meanwhile, back over the other side of the Atlantic, the Royal Navy had not outsourced escort carrier production entirely to the US. The large armed merchant cruiser Pretoria Castle was converted into an escort carrier capable of taking just over 20 aircraft, but was then largely used for trials, both to determine the best equipment for other escort carriers and to prototype certain items that were intended for the much larger and more capable 1942 Light Fleet Carrier program, also known as the Colossus class. This included her elevator, or lift in British parlance, which, with relatively minimal modification, would become the one that was used in the initial light fleet carriers. Next up, three roughly similar merchant hulls were converted into the Nairana class, although Nairana and Vindex were close enough to each other that they were essentially identical as carriers. Campania, which is usually classed as one of them, was a little bit larger and a little bit faster. All three ships had riveted hulls, which the Royal Navy considered to be somewhat better for Arctic convoy duty, given the issues that welded hull ships were having at that time in extreme cold conditions, and as a result, this is where they spent most of the war. They still only had a single elevator, which did hamper aircraft cycling somewhat, but this was in some ways offset by an extremely comprehensive and advanced radar and electronics suite, including an extensive operations room, or CIC in American, which combined to allow the ships to coordinate and guide both fighter defense against incoming air attack, anti-submarine search efforts, and anti-submarine attack operations all at the same time, which was quite remarkable for small escort carriers. Plus, they were fitted with an advanced homing system which was designed to allow aircraft to fly back to their carriers even in pitch black night or blizzard conditions, both of which were quite relevant on the Arctic convoy routes. Combined with an extensive anti-aircraft suite, it made them very popular on Arctic convoys, where the merchants faced perhaps the widest threat arrangement of any convoy system in World War II, as they could be attacked by submarines, aircraft, or potentially surface raiders, all possibly at once. While this combination was also present in the Mediterranean, at least there the Malta convoys could rely on the presence of major fleet units, including fleet carriers, whereas up in the high north, once they passed a certain point, the escort carriers were often pretty much all there was in terms of air support. Around about the same time as the Casablanca-class program was getting underway in the US, the Royal Navy was also revisiting the merchant aircraft carrier program. As we'd mentioned earlier, a mixture of tankers and grain carriers had been shortlisted, and these were now taken in hand for rapid conversion. A total of 19 ships took on the conversion, and they generally carried 3 to 4 swordfish, as the ships were smaller and slower than the escort carriers, which typically carried fighters as well as anti-submarine and search and attack aircraft. And of course, the escort carriers could also carry larger and more capable aircraft in general. The MAX, however, did help significantly with convoy escort. Although the U-boats were on something of a back foot by the time the MAX actually entered service, they only had one role, as opposed to the many roles which were being demanded of the escort carriers, and thus almost every convoy could sail with a MAC, which might be the only provision of constant air cover for the convoy, or they might supplement a full-sized escort carrier that was sailing as well. But it allowed the escort carriers to also be used in hunting groups independent of the convoys, which proved quite successful. Either way, the constant air cover provided by these small converted merchant ships was very helpful in minimizing losses. Wartime and design experience would all culminate in the final class of escort carrier, the American Commencement Bay class. These, like the Casablancas, were keel-up carriers, but they tried to combine the best of all the different classes that had come before them. The fact that they were keel-up designs, like the Casablancas, was combined with the overall hull type of a T3 tanker, as the provision of oilers for the US Navy was somewhat less of an issue by mid to late 1943, and they had tanker-style machinery layouts, as per the Sangamons. Thus, these ships were relatively fast for escort carriers at around 19 knots, with an extensive anti-aircraft battery that included a pair of 5-inch guns and over 50 barrels of light and medium anti-aircraft guns, a mixture of 40mm Bofors and 20mm Oerlikons. They could carry almost 36 aircraft thanks to the combination of a large hull and purpose-built design, but although 35 ships were planned, 16 would end up being cancelled as the end of war with Japan made further new escort carriers unnecessary. The last 4 ships that had been laid down, plus another 12 that were on the books but had yet to be laid down, were ordered to be stopped, and another 2, the Tinian and the Rabaul, would be completed but never entered active service. They were instead sent straight into the reserve fleet. Only 5 of the Commencement Bay type ships would complete in time to see any active service in World War II, and with them passed the time of the escort carrier. Most escort carriers of all types would be quickly decommissioned after the end of the war, and many were returned to civilian service as merchant ships. As the newest and most capable, the Commencement Bays were in some cases kept around for training, transport, and latterly helicopter assault roles, as well as anti-submarine warfare. But the new, heavier jets were far too large for them, and soon even the next post-war generation of anti-submarine warfare aircraft were experiencing the same issues. By the late 1950s, the Essex class, themselves now somewhat too small for the latest and greatest in frontline carrier aircraft, were replacing them in pretty much all of those roles, and with that, the last of the World War II escort carriers left the stage, although some would remain in reserve fleets until the 1970s. Over the course of World War II, though, the various ships had racked up considerable achievements. Although envisaged as aircraft transports and anti-submarine escorts only, they'd frequently ended up on the front lines. Not all the time willingly, admittedly, but they'd helped strike key enemy targets, like the battleship Tirpitz, they'd taken part in major assault operations, like Operation Torch, they'd supported all sorts of landing operations with direct air support for the troops on the ground, while the larger fleet carriers maintained air cover against enemy aircraft, or went after enemy bases, especially in the Pacific campaign, and they'd fed new aircraft to fleet carriers so that the larger carriers could stay on the front line. This was an especially valuable role with the British Pacific Fleet. Despite the moniker of combustible, vulnerable, and expendable from their crews on account of their almost complete lack of armour protection and the somewhat flammable nature of aviation fuel, losses among the escort carriers were actually surprisingly low. Only three British escort carriers were lost. The first two, Audacity and Avenger, were both sunk by U-boats, and another early escort carrier, the Dasher, exploded on her way back to port, a fate that triggered a reduction in the amount of aviation fuel carried on escort carriers and a little bit more attention paid to the remaining tank's integrity. On the US side, six escort carriers were lost. Block Island and Liscombe Bay were torpedoed by enemy submarines, German and Japanese respectively. The St. Lo, Bismarck Sea and Omani Bay were lost to kamikazes, and the Gambia Bay was famously sunk by the guns of the Japanese Centre Force at the Battle of Samar. Which actually means slightly more Allied fleet carriers were lost in combat than escort carriers, at least if you include the Independence class of light fleet carriers in the fleet carrier listings. But overall, this has been a relatively quick high-level run-through of the type's development and general use. If you'd like to see a deeper look into the wartime experiences of the escort carriers, then of course let me know in the comments below and I can add it to the list of things to do. And if you've made it this far, congratulations, you've reached the end of the main portion of the video, but there is a little special teaser or stinger, trailer? I don't know what it'd call it. Anyway, the bit at the end. Spoilers, maybe? In any case, Save the Ships, a wargaming group, that's tabletop wargaming, over in the US, has very kindly decided to sponsor one lucky viewer to receive 4 months Patreon membership on my Patreon at the Commander tier, so that means you get to vote on all sorts of fun things, including what kinds of videos or what subjects I should cover in the future. So if you'd like to win that particular little gift, then just drop me an email. There's contact email in the About section of the channel page. Or well, it's 5minuteguides@gmail.com. It's not that difficult. Just make sure you spell the five, not use the number. And if you want to spend a night on a historic ship playing tabletop war games, well, as you can see, this year they have arrangements lined up in Galveston, Baltimore, and Bay City this year, and possibly more to come. So if you happen to be in the area and you want to support your local museum ships, then that's a fun way to do it if you enjoy tabletop wargaming. Thanks very much to Save the Ships, and now I will release you back into the wild.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.